Okay, hey, it's always a pleasure to have David Hale of ESPN on the show. I know you're a busy man. You were just on the beaches, so this must be a real treat for you to hop on the show.
You say beaches. I was like on Feinbaum's set that was adjacent to a beach. It's not really, it's not as good. Well, I mean, you get more Feinbaum, but aside from that, it's not as good.
Well, I will compliment you. I do think you're one of the more highly entertaining guests that Feinbaum has on, but I wanted to ask you, does Paul even like you? Because I can't tell if he likes me. He's a difficult guy to read. I'm just wondering your thoughts.
I have an ongoing internal debate on this as well. I like to think so. I like to think it's like a friendly banter. It is possible that that friendly banter, like, is, you know, once I leave, he's like, that piece of shit. How is he? My theory on doing Feinbaum is that so far, and I couldn't even tell you how many times I've been on, I have yet to share actual information. I don't think we've ever actually discussed a topic that mattered. And somehow I've not gotten fired yet. But it's going to happen. When I get fired by ESPN, it will be for something that I said on Paul's show.
Okay, yeah, no, I can attest to that. Again, it's always highly entertaining. But let me ask you, was it entertaining coming off the SEC and the ACC spring meetings? I'm familiar with the SEC. I was down there last year, but I've never been to the ACC ones. Is it kind of the similar deal, or is it, you know, what is that like? And did you learn anything about the ACC this time around?
Yeah, for my purposes, they're dramatically different. The SEC is way more organized, and people stop and talk to you. And Greg Sankey is lovely and giving, you know, half an hour to an hour of his time every single day that you're there. Jim Phillips, you've got to track him like you're going through the Amazon or something like that, tracking Bigfoot. Like, he does not want to sit and chat. There is no like formal sit downs and press conferences or anything like that. But the informality of it, particularly if you have good relationships there, can be valuable too. And then because I get in with the ACC network and we get a good rate, I get to stay at the Ritz-Carlton there, that's real. At the end of the day, that's all I care about because I am selfish. But it is funny how much there was sort of a difference, not just in like how it functions, but like the lines of communication there, like the ACC, and it's really almost the inverse of what it used to be. The ACC's felt very aligned on where their thoughts were on a lot of the big issues. Now, I'm not saying I necessarily agree with a lot of what they say, particularly when it comes to the 2014 playoff, but there did seem to be some level of, if not unanimity, certainly alignment in the messaging. And even like the, you know, they came out afterwards and said, yeah, well, our coaches are unanimous on a 2014 playoff. And like literally 10 minutes later, Kevin Clark posted an interview from a few days earlier of him and Mario Cristobal, and Cristobal saying, I hate the 2014 playoff. And then immediately Miami backtracks like, well, he's in favor of whatever everybody else is in favor of. So there was at least this air of it. You know, being at the SEC, there just felt like a lot of people with a lot of ideas that were not, they had not been fully fleshed out or agreed upon or anything. Like it felt very much like everybody bring your own opinion and let's talk some of this stuff through. And look, I think Greg Sankey is 100% right in saying like, we cannot just rubber stamp a 2014 playoff without thinking through the ripple effects of this and the long-term implications. And there's tons of questions that I have that people have not provided anything close to a reasonable answer for, right up to what I think is the most important one, which is this actually going to mean more money for anybody? And they don't know that. So I think Greg Sankey's right, but I mean, it's funny to hear, I mean, Eli Drinkwitz has got his 32-team plan and there's plenty of places that think 24 is fine. And there's other ADs that are all for 16 and mad that they went to a 9-game conference schedule, assuming they were getting 16 and didn't. And then you've got probably a few, I mean, Kirby Smart will be the first to say like, oh, well, I'm fine with 4. We can go back to 4. So, you know, it's, and that was true of, you know, all of the big topics from, you know, self-governance to, you know, eligibility stuff. I mean, you've got LSU trying to get a pro NBA basketball player on their roster right now while the rest of their league is talking about 5-for-5 eligibility. There's just, I mean, and it's crazy to me because so for so long the SEC was the league where everybody, like, you know, it was the old Mike's Live saying it didn't happen until it's unanimous, and then the ACC was the one that 2 years ago two members of the league were suing the rest of the league, and it's almost flipped on its head.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you said that, Dave, because again, that's still fresh in my mind, and it's kind of like wondering is that conference even going to exist in the years to come. I think that's a fair question. I hope it does, but I mean, does that still loom over the whole thing, or have they kind of moved on from that?
I think it looms. It's the elephant in the room that nobody's talking about right now. And it's funny, on the last day of the SEC meetings, I kind of cornered Greg Sankey and peppered him with a few, are we just rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic here? Isn't this all going to blow up in 3 or 4 or 5 years? And he wouldn't take the bait from me, which that's a man who knows how to stay on message, and God bless him for that. But there is so much to me. I mean, it was interesting, too, because the the bipartisan Save College Athletics bill language came out during the SEC meetings. And I'm very dubious that any of this is going to get across the finish line anyway. But it was hard not to notice how much the language in that bill felt designed to put levels around the Big Ten and the SEC to keep them from continuing to grow and grow and grow and grow. And so if they're not allowed to expand, and if there's federal legal language that is trying to prevent super conferences, like, maybe we do stave off what feels like an inevitability. But I also, like, Pete Bevacqua testified before the Senate yesterday, and one of the things that he said was, like, I don't think that there is more money in pulling my phone is giving a yet another spam call. I don't think that there's more money in pulling our media revenue now. Like, I don't think that, like, pulling leagues is going to add a lot more money, but I do think that there might be more money in having – 32 team super conference where there's more great games being played against each other every week. That to me is very telling of where, like, I always say, like, follow the money, right? Well, the money suggests that a contraction at the top end and a widening of the middle is the most likely future scenario. And if that is the scenario, so much of what we're talking about at these meetings is just, you know, again, deck chairs in the Titanic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well said there. Well, I'm kind of curious. So for ESPN recently, you ranked all 138 FBS quarterback situations.
Who wouldn't want to dig up what New Mexico State and Kennesaw State's quarterback situations are? That's what you do in the offseason, right?
Well, absolutely. But I'm kind of curious, before we even dive into it, the response, the feedback, are you getting any nasty Twitter replies, emails, things of that nature?
I was smart to mute that conversation on Twitter right away. It's fun. There's probably not, like, look, anytime you do these lists, the end result is always to get people to complain. Like, that is, like, you need to know going into writing a list that no one is going to tell you that you got it all right. It's going to be complaints. I don't probably put more time into anything that I do every year than this story. Like, I do so much statistical research and stuff to put this together. And I was saying to somebody, I was joking earlier, it's like making Thanksgiving dinner. Like, you do it by yourself and you put all of this time into creating this beautiful spread, and then 5 seconds later, everybody's torn it apart and demolishing it. I got a little bit of hate is what I'm getting at. Like, the one that really got me, there were some very upset Rutgers fans. And I was like, you even exist? How are you mad?
I don't even know. Is it Jared Garantano still, or who's there? Well, okay. So tier one, your top four in the country. Of course, you got Trinidad. I like that. And then Arch Manning. How much does Paul's influence have Arch there in the top four?
The thing about Arch's season last year is, if his name wasn't Arch Manning, I think a lot of people would have said, yeah, that's how it's supposed to look. I mean, frankly, it wasn't markedly different than, say, CJ Carr's season last year, where the first couple of games against elite competition, you didn't play well. And it took a little while to get your footing and feel out who you were. And by the end of the year, you're looking and you're saying, he's playing as well as anybody in the country. And I think it was just so dramatic the attention that was put on his struggles the first month, which anybody taking the, I mean, it's, we forget because we watch people like Trevor Lawrence or Caleb Williams or, you know, the guys like that, that are like from the jump awesome, that like most guys, when they start their first game, there's a learning curve there. There's growing pains. And I think that's what you got with Arch. And by the end of the year, there was no part of me watching him that didn't think like, oh, he's really good. Like, he was as advertised by the end of the year. So if you assume like that he's past that growing pain stage and he's high enough up on the learning curve that he can show up, you know, day one this year and be playing at that same level. Like, again, could you be wrong? I mean, I guess we always have a chance of being wrong, but I think he's probably as safe a bet as there is right now.
And then in tier two, I thought this was pretty interesting. You got Sam Levitt, of course, the new LSU quarterback. I've gone back and watched him at Arizona State and, you know, impressed at times. I think he lacks a little consistency, but he'll wow you with some of the plays he makes. What's your thoughts on his fit playing for Lane Kiffin?
I mean, a little bit of it is you look at the LSU situation, you say like that could be great or it could completely blow up this year. Like, it's been a bit of a circus, but I think they're going to be very good. I think Sam Levitt's very good. I'm sort of a believer in like Kenny Dillingham might be a QB genius. Like, when you look at what he did with Jordan Travis and Bo Nix, and then Sam Levitt was kind of a cast off from Michigan State when he gets to Arizona State and they turned him into a guy who's playing at this level. You know, he's coming off of an injury. We have not gotten to see him play for a full year with that. I mean, Cam Scadabu was so much of what they had done 2 years ago. And I mean, this is a little, I feel the same about CJ Carter at Notre Dame this year. Is like, I think he's really good, but now you don't have Jeremiah Love in your backfield. Like, what is that going to look like? So I think there's tons of upside with Sam Levitt. I think he's probably very good. I just put it as like, if you're, you know, it's like a stock that probably has a little bit more room to go, but a little more risk as well.
And then in tier three, you got three SEC quarterbacks. Gunnar Stockton, he's kind of like a steady Eddie. But I really wanted to ask you about John Mateer at Oklahoma, Marcel Reed at A&M. It seems like those two, they have a lot of detractors, I'd say within their own fan base. You know, most of the fan base is behind them. But basically everybody else thinks those guys can't play. I'm not in that category. But what's your read on Mateer and Reed?
Yeah, and I kind of put Stockton into the same boat of like, they certainly can play. Like, I don't doubt at all they can play. Can they play at a high enough level consistently against elite opponents to win a national championship? Like, this is my question. It's not like, can they get you to the playoff? They all did. Can you win with them? Yeah, 100% you can. How many guys are better than them in the country? Like, it's a short list. You can count on two hands how many guys you'd rather have. But then you ask, is the ceiling quite high enough for what your aspirations at this program are? And if you're at Oklahoma, if you're at Texas A&M, if you're at Georgia, your aspirations are a national championship. And so my ask is, are they national championship quarterbacks? Now, look, last year you wouldn't have said at this time Fernando Mendoza is a national championship quarterback, and here we are. So guys can get better and improve. But you look at, like, Marcel Reed was just so inconsistent. When he was bad, he was bad. And John Mateer, like, I watched him at Washington State 2 years ago and thought he's one of the most electric players in the country. And it started out a little bit like that against the lesser competition. Then he gets hurt. So, like, I mean, he played, I think I looked this up and might say there in the story, that he played of the 10 FBS games he started, 8 of them came against top 25 defenses. Like, I mean, I don't know how you want to rank that guy. Like, I think the jury is out on John Mateer. And Gunnar Stockton, like, how much of who he's been and is about like Georgia's offense and the way it's designed and utilizing Zachariah Branch the way that they did. But like, can he beat you downfield? Can he really, you know, make it, and that's part of like some of the struggles in the running game have come because everything is so horizontal with them and crowded around the line of scrimmage. I think he's got to show this year that he can be a guy who can be a little more dynamic in the passing game. All of those things are going to be necessary for all of those guys for the teams to reach where they want to be.
And then all the way down in tier seven, Keelan Russell and Austin Mack at Alabama. Would it have changed anything if Alabama would have come out here and named a starter and you kind of knew who that was? Because it seems like Brian Grubb and DeBoer, you know, they've turned a lot of quarterbacks into gold here lately. And whoever wins that job is probably going to be pretty solid, I would think.
I think so, too. And a little bit of this is like that tier is just like I think they're going to, somebody here is going to be good. I just don't know who it is. And I don't know how good they're going to be right off the bat. And like, you know, part of this, like Ty Simpson was good last year, but struggled because Alabama could not get the running game going at any point. And I talked to Kalen DeBoer a good bit about this down in Destin a couple of weeks ago. Is like, you know, he said, like, people have sort of knocked us for our lack of physicality. It's not a lack of physicality. It's that our execution and design around the run game in particular has been bad. And that's something I think there's a focal point for them. If they get that figured out, I'm not worried, honestly, about the QB situation, because they've got two guys I think they should feel very good about. And the reason that he hasn't picked one, particularly now that there's not a spring portal, the reason not to pick one is because you really think both of them are still truly vying for that job. I think they're going to be fine. I think the ceiling for those quarterbacks is so much more about, are they getting some help?
In tier nine, you got the crafty vets. You got old Lenore Sellers. Is he somewhat of an afterthought? I mean, this time last year, people were talking about him being a top 10 pick, a Heisman front runner, perhaps. And now he's just kind of like, what? I don't even know if he's like the fifth or sixth best quarterback when people mention the best quarterbacks in this conference.
It's fascinating because, like, was Lenore Sellers, like, was that like a six game window of like catch lightning in a bottle and it's not repeatable? That's possible. But I also, I know, I mean, I talked to enough coaches who went against him who thought he was really good. He was in many ways as elusive last year, just in terms of broken tackles and forced missed tackles, as he had been the year before. But those plays didn't turn into these big miraculous moments that everybody remembers. They ended up 4 yard runs or something like that. And he did, I mean, look, he's got some pieces around him in that offense, but the offensive line last year was such a mess. And then, I mean, it was clearly the coordinator, play caller, and Lenoris did not see eye to eye last year. I mean, that was pretty clear. So you think that's an improvement too. I tend to be a buyer on Lenoris Sellers as a pretty good quarterback. The Heisman first overall pick, like, we may have been a bit a rush to judgment on that. Again, maybe, could be. We've seen the flashes of it. There's no reason he can't do it again. I tend to think, like, he's not nearly as bad as he was last year. He's probably not quite as good as he was during that final run through 2024. The truth is probably somewhere in the middle.
And I really wanted to ask you about in tier 11, you got it titled "The Waiting is the Hardest Part." Aaron Filo down at Florida. I believe he was pretty touted passer in high school, played at Tech the last couple of years. Anything you could share about him, and were you surprised at all that he hasn't yet seized that job? Or does that maybe tell you that Tramell Jones is better than people give him credit for, perhaps?
I think there's probably a little bit of that. I think there's probably a little bit of first-year head coach not going to stake out too much territory early on. Because, I mean, look, when you're just installing the spring for a first-year head coach, I mean, it's almost everybody anymore, the way that rosters turn over, particularly for a first-year head coach. The spring is so much about identifying the groundwork. Like, you've both, if both quarterbacks have passed like John Summerall 101 and 102, that's great. We can't really decide on anything until you see them at the 201, 301, 401 level of the John Summerall experience. So I think there's probably a little of that. I've talked for a couple of years now about Aaron Filo with Brent Key at Georgia Tech, and Key loved him. Buster Faulkner, who's now the OC at Florida, loved him. They were very upset to lose him at Georgia Tech. And it's funny, 2 years ago when Haynes King was banged up and had a shoulder injury where he literally could not throw the football, they were sort of splitting time. And if it was going to be a pass play, Filo was on the field. And if it was going to be a run play, Haynes King was on the field. The fact that defenses didn't catch on to this as quickly as they should have is crazy to me. But also, like, that's putting Filo in a pretty tough situation where people can kind of, you know, you can know by the personnel what's going to happen. And I thought he thrived. I thought he looked really good in a number of times. So, like, he's the guy I'm high on. That old tier is guys, though, that have, you know, they've had to sort of wait their turn. And some of them have moved up the depth chart because somebody else has moved on. Some of them have moved on themselves. To me, that is one of the most interesting tiers on that list. And it's guys that I think, like, have a chip on their shoulder and something to prove, but a big opportunity and a good bit of talent. And wouldn't be surprised if, you know, a couple of those guys flame out and don't end up great. But I'd be very surprised if there's not at least one or two gems in that list.
And I really wanted to ask you, just out of my own pure ignorance, on some of these ACC teams that are playing the SEC opponents early in the season, particularly Louisville. Is that a legitimate playoff contender out of the ACC playing Ole Miss in Nashville?
You know, it's interesting. If Louisville was in the SEC, would we be saying they're a legitimate playoff contender? I'm a little, I don't know, maybe. Maybe. I think they're good. They're going to be good at the line of scrimmage. They've got a really good skill position. They've upgraded at tight end. They've got genuinely one of the most electric running backs in the country in Isaac Brown. Their defense showed real improvement last year. Clev Lubin, their edge rusher, is another guy who's going to be in All-America consideration to start the season. So much is going to come from another guy in that tier that we were just talking about, Lincoln Kienholz, who pushed Julian Sayin for the starting job at Ohio State last year, transfers to Louisville. I think Jeff Brohm is one of the elite offensive play callers in the country. And what Jeff Brohm has never had in his time at the Power Four level, both at Purdue and at Louisville, is a guy who's truly a dual threat quarterback. Lincoln Kienholz is a hell of a good athlete. He can run. Now, I think there's still some questions. When you say dual threat, it implies the passing is a given and the running is a bonus. I'm not sure the passing is a given with him. I want to see a little bit more. So, you know, if you're getting high-level QB play from him, I think Louisville absolutely is in that playoff conversation. And if you go back and look, Jeff Brohm's first 3 years in Louisville, I mean, their losses, all but maybe one of them, are just like head-scratchers or near misses, or the team completely blew up at the end of the game. Go back and watch Louisville-Stanford from 2 years ago, and you will walk away just with tears in your eyes. How did something this stupid happen on a football field? So, I mean, I think that's going to be a really good game, and particularly when you consider, like, there's a lot of unknown about Ole Miss as we get started in this. I mean, this is credit to Pete Golding for winning two playoff games and playing really damn well in the third one, but this is a sort of the start of a new era now.
Well, it's a new era in Baton Rouge as well. And I mean, go back a year. This was, you know, game of week one. I guess it is again, right? Game day, I believe, at Clemson at LSU. But, I mean, is there any...
I don't think they're there for the Clemson half of this anymore, though. They're there for the guy on the sideline for LSU.
Yeah, no, without a doubt. I mean, and I believe it's a double-digit spread. I mean, this is crazy. Can Clemson even make this a competitive game?
There is probably no team that I feel more uncomfortable making a guess about their season than Clemson right now, because what logic would tell me is a lot what that point spread tells you, which is that they're not that good. And they're coming off a 7-6 season, a 7-6 season, mind you, where they just put nine dudes into the draft. They've got a quarterback who's got one career start under his belt. And honestly, there's a freshman that they've gotten, Tate Reynolds, who could push him. I've asked Dabo Sweeney if it feels a little like 2014 when they had Deshaun Watson waiting in the wings behind the guy, Cole Stout, who had been like the heir apparent for several years. And he said, yeah, it is kind of like that. Well, we saw what happened with Deshaun Watson. It just took a few weeks to get there. I could see that happening again here. And speaking of 2014, they brought back their coordinator from 2014 and Chad Morris. I don't think there's a lot of buyers on the upside of that. I like Chad. I think that he probably his time at Arkansas certainly hurt his reputation quite a bit, but I still think he knows offense. There's a lot of things that shouldn't work at Clemson right now. And so you lean and say, yeah, of course, LSU's going to win in a landslide. But here's the thing. Dabo Sweeney's entire career is based on what shouldn't work and did. So it's like all of my logic says this is probably the least talented Clemson team we've seen in 15 years, coming off the worst season they've had in 15 years, with a bunch of decisions made by Dabo Sweeney this offseason that people like us are scratching our heads over. Like, all logic tells you that's going to be bad. And yet, Dabo Sweeney's entire life is based on stuff that has defied logic. So I'm not going to be the one to walk out on the limb and call it done.
Well, what's defying my logic is how Mike Norvell is still at Florida State, but they're playing at Alabama. What can you tell us about FSU? And I mean, I would have bet literally everything I owned last year that Alabama was going to whip FSU, and it turned out to be the exact opposite. I mean, is there any shot we see something similar here?
So much of what happened last year with that Alabama game to me felt like FSU sneaking up on Alabama. That's not going to happen. Like, if FSU doesn't have Alabama's attention this year, like, fire Kalen DeBoer, the minute the game's over because you failed as a coach. Like, if you haven't gotten Alabama's attention after that, you know, FSU is not without talent, but they are not anywhere close to Alabama's level of talent. Now, look, we saw Ashton Daniels take Alabama to the wire last year in the Iron Bowl with an Auburn team that also wasn't very good. I think there's more sort of under the hood with Ashton Daniels than we've seen. But again, I mean, what is he going to be like? The eighth best quarterback, the ninth best quarterback that Alabama sees this year? I just can't see any world that it happens, especially in Tuscaloosa. Like, I'm not going to go here and say something stupid to you, like I'll shave my head if FSU wins. But, you know, look, I'm sure you could probably find plenty of people who would, there's a guy when FSU played Boston College in week two years ago, who said that he would literally eat shit if Florida State lost that game and then backed out on doing it when they lost. And there's people who point the finger at him and say, he's the entire reason FSU is where it is. I'm not going to be that guy.
Yeah, two girls, one cup style, I guess, huh? But
man, this is, I don't know that this show is a family-friendly show anymore.
No, I don't think it ever was. And it's not going to be on Rocky Top if they lose to Georgia Tech week two. That feels like a massive game for Tennessee. How big is it for Tech in their season?
Pretty big, because so much of that will be Georgia Tech has made huge strides over the last couple of years under Brent Key. So much of that game will become this early referendum on, was it what Brent Key is doing at Georgia Tech and it's sustainable, or was that Haynes King's a really awesome dude who plays tough as nails and put a team on his back and carried a program for 3 years? Like, you could make either case. And I think if they go out and look, they're going to be tough to beat, because it's in some ways they're a mile away from the old Paul Johnson triple option offense. And in some ways they're exactly that still. And the one thing that Paul Johnson did was make life very difficult for you. You might beat him, but you weren't going to have fun doing it. There's a lot of that with this Georgia Tech team. And I don't know what we're going to get out of Mendoza at quarterback. One of the interesting things, I talked to Brent Key earlier this offseason, and I was asking him about Mendoza and what he thinks he's got with him. And he's like, you know, the thing I keep trying to remind Alberto is, you don't need to be Haynes King. You're taking his job here, but you don't need to be him. And you definitely don't need to be your brother. You don't need to be a first round draft pick and a Heisman winner and a national championship right now. We just need you to be Alberto Mendoza. And for a guy who's never started a game at a school most people are not paying attention to, I think he feels there's a lot to live up to, and this will be his first big test on that too. So to me, this game means a ton for Georgia Tech. And then you talk to, you know, Tennessee fans, where there's this, like, you know, when you leave the stove on simmer, it's like, it's fine. You can walk away for a while, but honestly, your kitchen can burn down pretty quickly as well. It feels like there's a simmer at Tennessee right now, and it's best to put that fire out before it gets too big.
Oh yeah, no doubt. All right. And the last one I wanted to ask you about, NC State, they're playing Vanderbilt week three. Mm-hmm. Vanderbilt's not going to sneak up on anybody anymore. They'll have a little bit of a target on their back. What could you tell me about NC State?
I really like NC State as sort of a sleeper in the ACC this year. Now, I have concerns about their skill positions on offense. Like, they are, I mean, it is completely start from scratch at wide receiver, basically. But I love their quarterback. CJ Bailey is a dude. He's really big. He's like 6'7", but he's really fine tuned to the mechanics. He does not make mistakes. He's in, I think, 120, 150 snaps in the red zone, zero career turnovers. He's a playmaker. I think they're going to be good at running the ball. They're going to be pretty good on defense this year. That's going to be an intriguing matchup, because then, you know, then you've got the flip side of it with Vandy. And it's like, I still think there's a lot to like at Vandy, but if they're trudging out a guy making his third career start as a true freshman, which I think most people expect is going to be the case, like, you know, DJ Elliott and that NC State defense can create some problems.
And do you think there's any pressure on the ACC to win some of these games so they can get an extra playoff bid or two?
Yeah, I was talking to an ACC coach who has some playoff aspirations just yesterday, and he was like, if we go out in week 1, 2, 3 and we flub all of these games again, there is no fixing it. Like, he's like, we have to win games in order to change the narrative. And it's, I think this is a little bit, I mean, the ACC was pushed into a corner by the SEC and going to a 9-game conference schedule because they just had to at that point. But it doesn't help the ACC any. Everybody, like, beating other ACC teams is not changing people's thoughts about the ACC. Winning against the SEC does. People look at Miami completely differently because they beat Notre Dame, because they went into the playoff and beat Ohio State, Texas A&M, and Ole Miss. That is the story for Miami. Nobody gives a damn. Everybody forgot that they lost to Louisville and SMU, two ACC teams. That didn't matter. They beat teams that people thought were good from other leagues, and that's all that's going to matter when we talk about the narrative.
Yeah, well, it'll be either the further decay of the SEC or the rise of the ACC. David Hale, ESPN. Can you tell my audience before you go how to follow you and how to find all your work?
Well, you can go to ESPN.com, and sometimes there's some stuff up there. Basically all of my socials are at a David Hale joint, like Spike Lee, who's, by the way, Spike Lee, congrats to you. You're having a really nice NBA playoffs right now. I hope he's enjoying it. And then I got a show on ACC Network. If y'all ever want to, like, slum it and watch what the other league is doing, me and Andrea Adelson host the show Wednesdays at 5 and talk about ACC stuff. So, you know, I don't know if you're trying to get to sleep in the middle of the day or something. Tune into that.
And the occasional Simpsons meme as well.
Oh, as many as I can. That is 90% of my content, actually.
All right.